Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we meet friends and neighbors from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Veterinarian Barbara Oglesby lives a life just about as exotic sounding as the exotic animals she treats. She's gone digging for mastodon bones, traveled the country in an Airstream, and roller skated through Burning Man. And her day job brings her in contact with some pretty interesting characters, too. Cleo the rabbit, Sammy the macaw, and Rocky the cockatiel. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Oglesby.
Thank you for having me. I'm an avid listener.
Oh, thank you for joining us today. So you work at MedVet in Hilliard, and you specialize in birds and exotic animals. So what qualifies as an exotic animal here in Ohio?
Well, not all of them are actually exotic. Most people wouldn't consider them exotic. So it's basically any pet that's not a dog or a cat. So certainly birds and reptiles, which are exotics, but rabbits, guinea pigs, ferrets, really anything other than dogs and cats.
Okay, so I hear that you have treated, you know, a lot of different types of animals, maybe even the occasional swan. Have you treated a swan?
Yeah. So we see actually a lot of backyard poultry and waterfowl. So swans, ducks, a lot of chickens. So many owners right now think, oh, I'm going to be a little backyard farmer and have my little flock and have fresh eggs every day, and then get very, very attached to their chickens and treat them a lot more like pets. So we see a lot of backyard poultry that are actually pets, too. Also, we see some more exotics, I guess, like fennec foxes, red kangaroo. They're not legal here in Ohio, but they are in surrounding states, and there just aren't that many exotic animal veterinarians, so they'll travel here to MedVet to see us.
So someone from another state is raising a kangaroo, like, in their house?
Yeah, well, red kangaroos, they're not the full size. They're smaller kangaroos and wallabies. But yeah, they stand about 3 feet tall, 3-4 feet tall. So they're pretty large. Not that they're, I don't agree that they make great pets personally, but they're wild animals. But yeah, I'm here to help them and in any capacity that I can help with the husbandry, especially, which tends to be the biggest problems. They're not suited to living in homes. So often husbandry issues are going to create the diseases that we see.
Yeah, I can't imagine, you know, taking my dog or cat to MedVet in Hilliard and having a kangaroo hop in one day, you know,
like, right. That, well, it happens.
Yeah.
there are often some surprises.
How does one get, I understand how you ended up getting trained in the bird specialty, because, you know, if you're good at like cockatiels and macaws and parrots and that kind of thing, you can do all kinds of other birds. But how does one get trained in kangaroos?
Well, now, currently, there are courses that are offered in veterinary schools, and then there are internships and residencies that you would do after graduating veterinary school. So there are really two different types of exotic animal medicine that one would practice. And one is the companion exotics, which I do, which are pet exotics. And the other is zoo and wildlife animal medicine, which is very different, as you can imagine, going in and treating animals that are not used to being handled and need to have some sort of restraint or chemical restraint, be anesthetized in order to do a physical exam. It's a very different type of medicine than companion animal medicine, where they're used to being picked up, handled, sometimes really happy to see you, like a lot of our birds. So it's a very different type of medicine. Well, and so depending on what you wanted to do, if you were interested in zoo medicine or zoo wild medicine, then you would do your internship and residency at a zoo or a wildlife center. Whereas if you're interested in pet medicine, you would do an internship or a residency with someone like me, or at a university setting where they have an active program that see pets in a clinical setting.
And you're the only emergency hospital in the 4-state region that has vets that with exotic animal experience. So you're available 24/7. I can imagine the workload might be heavy at times, but interesting always, right?
Sure, sure. And I am available. Also, Dr. Joe is our other exotic animal veterinarian at MedVet, and he is available. We have right now an intern and have various numbers of interns or residencies, depending on the year, and they would share with that load as well. And also, if an emergency veterinarian chooses to work at MedVet Hilliard, then they want to see exotics, and they are also trained very well in treating exotic animal emergencies. And so they're not just emergency dog cat veterinarians, but they're really exotic specialists in their own right in emergency. They are some of these emergency procedures, they're probably better at it than me doing those procedures because they're seeing them all the time 24/7, whereas I'm seeing more the scheduled appointments.
You were featured in Ohio State's Alumni Magazine, and it showed a picture of you with cockatiels and macaws. You started on this path of what you're doing because your own parrot was injured years ago. Can you tell us how it became your life's work?
Right. So I had a pet parrot that had my heart, and he injured his leg. And this was before I really even considered going to veterinary school. And I called around and had a great difficulty finding someone even willing to see them. And then finally, when I did, they really didn't know how to handle him, exactly what to do with him. And that's when I learned that it wasn't taught in most veterinary schools. It was very rare. One or two programs had a little bit of exotic animal or avian medicine, but generally it wasn't taught. And I was really distressed by that because I loved this animal and I wanted him to be treated. And so I went to vet school so that I could create a program to have it taught. And I created one here at Ohio State, which for many years we did have a clinic. Right now, the clinical rotations are with me at MedVet, but I'm still teaching all the didactic courses, the classroom courses in companion exotics here. So it's been going strong for 30 years here now since I joined them.
So it's not that you got bored with dogs and cats. It was that you found you saw a hole and you found a need and you needed to fill it.
Right, right. And this was before I even finished undergrad. Yeah, so I wasn't planning to go to vet school until that happened.
This is Fascinating Ohio, where we meet neighbors with an interesting story to tell. And we are talking with veterinarian Barbara Oglesby, who specializes in birds and exotic animals. So the teaching component of your work, how many vets are out there today who know how to handle exotic animals thanks to you?
Well, in general, not necessarily thanks to me, but how many are out there? My biggest answer is not enough. I hear that all the time, that there aren't enough, especially people who are traveling from West Virginia, from Pennsylvania, from Michigan, Kentucky, coming in to see me. They really would like to have specialists in their state and not have to travel. And I would love for them to have specialists in their state as well. Across the country, it's hard to say how many are actually specialized, and there is a special board certification that you can attain. And as far as avian, there are a little over 100 in the U.S. that are board certified in avian, and I'm not quite sure of the number of the exotic companion mammals, which would be rabbits, ferrets, guinea pigs, you know, the smaller mammals. There are probably around 100 too, would be my best guess.
Yeah.
So not many.
Yeah. I've read articles about the need for more veterinarians and how hard it is. There's not enough of you. There's lots of pets needing care. You're usually on call 24/7. People's pets get injured or need help at all hours of the day. So what would you say to someone out there who is thinking about becoming a veterinarian, knowing that it'll be hard, but it's needed?
Yeah, I would encourage it. And it's really interesting because I really feel that the people who become veterinarians are just all incredibly down to earth, warm-hearted people, and they do understand that they're going into this not for the, you know, fame and glory and income, but because of their passion for what they do, passion not only for the animals but for the people. You're not dealing with just the animal, you're dealing with the owner 50-50% basically, so you have to really be good with both animals and with people. And they get into it because they love it, because they love what they're doing, and they know that they are making a difference in someone's life every day, and not many professions give you that.
And earlier you mentioned that sometimes you need longer appointments because you have to also spend time educating the owner of these exotic pets. So new reptile patients need longer appointments. Can you tell the story of recently examining Kingsley? Tell us about him.
So I was trying to, that was in the article. Yeah. So a little bearded dragon, and really generally being very well cared for, but sometimes over cared for. So you can cause, or disease can occur not only because of deficiencies in diet and husbandry, and this goes across all species, but also for excesses. So feeding excess food, just like putting on weight for us, is going to have a negative impact on our health. It's going to have a negative impact on the health of our animals too. And it's a little difficult to tell with our friends who have feathers or who have scales, and especially I'd say those with feathers, they're covering up what the body looks like underneath. So you may not know that your animal is getting morbidly obese because you're not seeing what's under there, or the opposite. Our species that we see, usually all of them, other than say ferrets, for example, are prey species, whereas our dogs and cats are predators. So those prey species have an instinct to hide the fact that they're sick or something's going to come and eat them. And sometimes even their own flock members will kick them out or ignore them too. So it's not just they're trying to hide the fact that they're sick from their owner, but it's just an instinct to do that. So they can look great and act completely normal when the owner's in the room, and then just be sort of lethargic. And then you put feathers on top of that and you can't tell that they're losing weight. And a lot of our pet owners come in and feel horrible when I say, oh, your animal's really thin. This is a disease process that's been going on for a while, and it's absolutely not their fault. I mean, they've been hiding it. So learning to recognize those things and educating the owners on little things to look for so that they can be treated before things get more severe. And I'd say that also applies to rabbits. I'd say that is really one of the most difficult discussions that I end up having. If you have a dog or a cat and they go a day without eating, but otherwise they're running around acting like their normal self, you wouldn't say, oh, I need to rush them to the vet, this is an emergency. Mm-hmm. But if a rabbit goes, in some cases, more than 8 hours without eating, they can die. So it's really important. And even if they're acting normal, even if they're running around and acting normal up to the very end, they need to be seen if they suddenly stop eating.
Even though it's not a dog or a cat, is a rabbit considered an exotic pet?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why I said that not all we would think is exotic, but exotic companion medicine, animal medicine, really just encompasses, again, anything that's kept as a pet that's not a dog or a cat. So different mammals and, of course, non-mammalian species. And I don't do them, see them, but Dr. Joe in our practice also treats fish and amphibians and axolotls.
Yeah.
So I always find it fascinating when those come in and watch him do his magic on his non-traditional species as pets.
Yeah. I would never have, I had lots of fish growing up, I would have never thought of taking a fish to a vet. And axolotls are all the rage in my kids' elementary school. They're a big deal now.
Right.
Well, just one final question before I let you go. You don't just treat exotic animals. You're not just a veterinarian. You also have lots of other parts of your life. Can you tell us how you ended up digging for mastodon bones?
Yeah, I actually am into it mostly through my husband, who is a passion for it. And we were involved in two different digs, one at Cedar Fork, the Cedar Fork Macedon, working with Dr. Nigel Brush from Ashland University, and also with Dr. Mike Ramley from Boston. And that went on for about four seasons. And then currently we're working on the Lower Blue Lick Macedon down in Kentucky. And we're three going on four seasons. And that day with Dr. Mike Gramley. And in these cases, we're not looking for a mastodon skeleton that, so that we can reassemble and have it in a museum. Mm-hmm. These are prehistoric Pleistocene age workshops where they're actually breaking down these bones and using them as tools. So they're more processing centers. So we're not only looking for the bones themselves, but for signs of use and what those bones were used for. And in the Blue Lick, we also have found evidence of processing of bison, llama, mammoth, and mastodon.
So you're exotic veterinarian by day and amateur archaeologist, paleontologist by night.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You also also own an Airstream. Do you
love my Airstream?
Where do you travel? Where's your favorite place to go?
My daughter lives in Chicago, and so one of the ways that we meet up is to, you know, go up to Kelly's Island and meet halfway or Indiana Dunes. So I really like doing that. And then once a year, I take it across the country and go out to the Burning Man, which goes on for about a week. And I really love that week that I get to spend out there. And, you know, to retirement will be coming up soon. So we plan to do a lot more traveling in the Airstream.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with veterinarian Barbara Oglesby, who specializes in birds and exotic animals. Thank you for joining us today.
No, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me. It was a delight.
And coming up, we will be talking to another fascinating Ohioan. This one fixes up some truly dirty cars. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. Their Instagram page describes them as three dudes from Ohio who like to detail cars. With more than 1 million subscribers on Instagram and YouTube, they're not the only ones who like car detailing, especially when those cars are barn finds that haven't seen the light of day in a long time. Here with the dirty details behind the YouTube channel is RJ Wagner. Welcome to All Sides.
How you doing, Amy? I'm thanks for having me.
So, RJ Wagner, you are part of WD Detailing. Can you tell me how you got involved in detailing cars?
Well, funny enough, my first job that I've ever had was working at a car wash at 14. I rode my bike up there, applied, got the job, and I guess that's the inception of my passion for detailing. And then it's evolved over time. I ran a mobile detailing business when I was in school for accounting in college. The accounting career did not exactly pan out the way I thought it was going to. And so I kind of came back from school and continued to detail. And then we eventually started making videos on some of the dirty cars that we'd find through our through the detailing business. And then WD Detailing ended up kind of being born from that.
So you have a YouTube channel, you have an Instagram, WD Detailing, and what made you decide one day to be like, oh, I should take a video of this. I think other people should see how dirty this car is.
that credit goes to my business partner almost solely. At the time he was working for me at my detailing business, and he had always been very fascinated with social media. He even had a small following himself, but he had been interested in detailing as well. Started working for me and said, "Hey, like we should really try filming one of these cars. I watch a lot of content online of people detailing, and I think it would be cool to try and make a video." And so we had tried a couple times at customers, on site. It was a mobile detailing business, so a lot of times we were on, in someone's driveway trying to film a video. And that is very difficult to do. Filming takes almost twice as long as like a typical detail job, just because you have to move the camera and get the shot. So we eventually decided in February of 2020 that if we were going to actually try to make content, we would set up dedicated days where we would find the dirtiest car we could and then film the whole entire process and really, really give it our full attention, at least for that day out of the week. And then we would post our videos online, one per week. I guess the story goes is that we posted our first video February 28th of 2020. And then we posted one a week. Actually, we posted one a week every week for 5 years straight now. But our third video ended up getting 1 million views. And I told Brent, I go, "We are not going to stop this unless it's detrimental for for some other aspect of our life, our health, or, if someone, if we needed to find, if we couldn't pursue the dream anymore due to other reasons, then I guess we would have stopped." But I told him we're not stopping. So, and of course, everyone knows what happened in March of 2020.
Right.
A lot of people had to stay home and watch YouTube or Netflix. So I guess, it ended up favoring us as much as it didn't favor the rest of the world.
Maybe people were at home during that time and they were able to be like, I should really take a look at that old car I have sitting in my barn right now. And then that inspired them, you guys. So basically, you find people contact you, I guess, and because they have a really old car that just hasn't been touched in a long time. You go out there, you take some video. But I watch some of these videos. I mean, some of these cars are amazing, but they haven't been touched in decades. Does that surprise you? Does it ever surprise you that someone has this car and they haven't touched it?
Not anymore. But that's just because I've done, we've made over 230-ish long form videos on YouTube. It's actually funny you ask that. I've always wondered what the mindset is I understand some cars. I as a car guy myself, I've had a project car that, is not worth as much, or that it would cost more than the car is worth to get it back on the road. But you know that you're going to lose money when you sell it. And there's some factors that play a part of, I guess, your decision making on, I guess, leaving a car to sit for so long. But, the car that I had was very cheap. It was only a couple, $2,500 when I bought it. But some of these cars that we work on, for example, one of them, it was a Ferrari. 512 BB, which is
saw that Ferrari video. It was abandoned for 28 years.
I don't know how you do that. I mean, that car it was a very, very cool Ferrari. It was actually the precursor to the Testarossa. It had the big 80s, rear end with the rear engine, as well as, the kind of iconic Ferrari circular taillights. And it was just such a beautiful car, and it was just kind of left to sit there. And it wasn't even a money or a health, a health issue, which usually when people leave cars like this, it's because of their health failing them, or life, kids, getting married, having kids, moving, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes that takes precedence, which I guess it should over your sports car. But this gentleman had, he was wealthy. He did have lots of other cars. But it behooves me to see some of these iconic cars that we were lucky enough to find sitting there, especially the very, very low mileage ones. And I might be rambling a little bit right now, but we'd actually find this is the craziest find that we've ever found. It was a garage in Southern Ohio. It was an old farmer who had bought three of the same Corvettes. They were both C3 Corvettes, and two were 1978s, and then one was a 1982. And
is that the one mileage... that is that the one that only had? Yeah, go ahead. I saw that video.
Yeah, I mean, just in this, I really don't understand. He thought that it would be a good investment to buy these Corvettes and basically not drive them. So one had 1,600 miles, the next one had 293 miles, and the last one, the 1982, had 33 miles, which is just...
Just
I mean,
three, listeners, either, just 33 miles. That's like down the road
miles.
And
it
back.
Still had the, it only had, it had the original temp tag and the plastic on the seat still. It just, you know, he never used them. And okay, you know, maybe the investment, I can understand someone trying to make that decision or trying to make that... you know, thinking that that was a good idea. But unfortunately, he did pick the wrong Corvettes. He could have put his money in the S&P 500 and done very, very well, very well, way better than he did on the cars. But the worst part of it, well, I guess the best part for us was that he just let the garage kind of become dilapidated to where raccoons got inside. And when I say raccoons got inside, I mean like they we literally had to use a front end loader to remove the amount of raccoon feces from this garage.
Oh man.
I'm talking hundreds of pounds of raccoon raccoon feces. It was insane. And the cars were, you know, they weren't covered. It wasn't heated. So I mean, really just kind of destroy these cars by leaving them there. And thankfully we were able to clean them up and make them look as like new as possible. And truthfully, they would have been great museum cars because you're not going to drive a car that old with 33 miles on it, and, you know, ruin the value of it. But, you know, I know for a fact actually that all three of those cars, granted now they are covered because we bought him covers and we put, moisture remover, containers inside to make sure that doesn't grow any mildew or mold. But I know for a fact that those cars are still sitting there and he had good offers on them. So, long-winded way of saying sometimes the mentality just doesn't make any rational sense.
We are talking with RJ Wagner, the co-owner of WD Detailing, about the YouTube channel and the Instagram account that has more than 1 million subscribers. And do people hire you, but you also sometimes do this for free? Is that right?
We actually only, so I just recently made our actual service business defunct or closed it. I mean, I still will pay taxes at the end of the year, but you know, I don't have the time to do the service business, the service side of things anymore. So yes, we only film videos for YouTube now, and we actually do all the work for free. And sometimes if it's the right car and the right condition, and we know that our viewers will really, really like it, and we you know need to kind of sweeten the pot to make the deal happen. We've even paid to do a lot of these cars.
Wait, please let me clean your car.
Yes, exactly. You'd be surprised how hard it is to get some people to agree to a free detail. So,
are they all in Ohio or do you travel?
The majority, we try to stay local within, mm-hmm. you know, an hour or two drive of our shop here in Cleveland. But we've gone as far as New Hampshire. So Cleveland to New Hampshire, Cleveland to Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, Traverse City, Michigan. So we've, as far as we probably traveled is around 500 miles away from our shop. So we've become road dogs over time, I guess.
Now, some of these videos get a little emotional. I saw you fixed up a Dodge Viper for a man whose brother passed away. When his brother passed away, he left him the car, but that man had some medical problems and he just couldn't take care of it. It really needed some TLC. Can you tell me about that experience?
That it's very funny you say that because we actually have a car inside our shop right now that's is that same gentleman's vehicle. He's actually become a great friend of the channel. And that's how we met him, was working on this Viper that his brother did leave him. But since we have, we pulled that Viper out of his yard, we cleaned it up and then brought it back to him. Because of that video, he had a childhood friend reach out to him that offered to paint the car for free. So that car is now freshly painted. Has new tires, and he actually gets to enjoy it with his daughters, and he's a very good man, and he's been a great friend of the channel, and that's probably one of the most rewarding things about what we do is we meet a lot of fantastic human beings that are all connected through, I guess, our love for our enthusiasm for, you know, cars and I guess cleaning cars, and so when we get to have stories like that, and we get to make connections like that and kind of tell a story that that surpasses, I guess, the metal, glass, and plastic that these cars are made out of. That makes it all very well worth it.
Yeah, you had him in tears because it just reminded him of his brother, right? You know, his brother wasn't here anymore, but this car made him think of him and it looked brand new. So it's a lot of these cars that you work on, do they still run? They just need TLC? Like that one you just gave an example that it does work, right? Do most of them still work?
Most of them do not.
Okay.
if I'm being honest. And that's probably the next iteration. What we hope to achieve in the next couple of years is to try and find a way to probably make, because we make one video a week, and this is actually some behind the scenes information that I'm giving right now. But
breaking news? Okay.
I think in the future we're going to start making less videos, but we're going to try and focus more on stories where, you know, it's a great car, a great person, and a great story. But instead of just cleaning it and bringing it back, because ideally, you know, our MO is to clean the car and give the owner the energy or the desire to go in there and take the next step to get it fixed. And so I think in the future we won't make as many videos each month, but when we do make these videos with the extra time, we're hoping to kind of incorporate actually getting the car mechanically running again and being able to share that experience with the owner of the, not only the car being cleaned and looking nice again, but then being able to go on a drive.
Would you entertain, I mean, some of your videos look like they're TV shows in the making. Would you entertain the idea of a TV show?
We had actually been approached and thankfully we did not get accepted into the TV show. I think it was through Discovery. I don't even know if I have an NDA on that, but I don't care anymore. I think it's well gone. I think it's gone now, but or I think the NDA is over now. But, you know, I'm glad that never transpired, because it's me, my business partner, Brent, and then my best friend, Mike, that filmed these videos. And we all have complete creative control, and there's no fabricated conflict between each other. It's very organic and it's very authentic to who we are. And I don't think that having a production company or a studio that's, you know, saying, hey, we need you guys to do this, or what if we added this to the car, what if we made it dirtier, so I don't really know if there's even money that would be able to make us kind of sacrifice what we have here, because we own everything, we own every piece of it, and it's a direct reflection and extension of who we are.
And when you, in some of the videos I saw that you have launched your own product line, were you not finding cleaning products that were working for you, that you wanted to create your own?
It was more so. So with complete transparency, we actually are working with the same company, because I'm not a chemist. And I would, if I tried to formulate my own products, we would not be doing well anymore. So I'm actually working with the same company that I've worked with for the past 10 years. And they're local here in Ohio. And we actually get to be a part of the formulation and the blending process. So we went through their full catalog. We made some changes to around 8 products. You know, we found the product and then kind of made them ours. We added more surfactants to make their more foam or this scent or remove this, et cetera, et cetera. So it's cool, because although you know, technically is a private labeled company, or rather product, we have much more control with this, with our products than a lot of companies do. So the long or the short winded way of saying is, we've actually curated this line to be the best products that we could possibly curate. And, I'm very proud of it. We put a lot of work into it. And, like I mentioned, my good friend, Michael, who works for us in WD Detailing, is a business partner in WD Auto Supply. So we wanted to make sure that everyone has a piece of ownership and can feel like they're working towards something bigger than, I guess, all of us.
So if someone's listening to us now and they have a old dusty car with a backstory, how do they get in touch with you?
So the best way to get in touch would be to go to, or rather to email us at wdbarnfinds@gmail.com and send us a picture of what car you have and send us where you're located. And please send the picture, because some people do just tell us what they have, you know, through text, and it's very difficult to answer all the messages. So we try and kind of prioritize the ones that have pictures. So if you do have anything particularly 70s, 80s classic American cars or classic German cars or Japanese cars. Really, anything that you think is very cool, send us pictures and send us where you're at, because we're willing to travel. We do all the work for free. We're fully licensed and insured. We trailer the cars and we clean them for free. And a lot of people all around the world enjoy the content.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Amy.
You are listening to Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and that was R.J. Wagner, one of the co-owners of WD Detailing. And this is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we meet friends and neighbors from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Christina Taylor Florence is author of the children's book, The Day Built by Kindness. She's also an educator. Welcome to the show, Christina.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So one of the last pages of the book notes that this book was inspired by witnessing the effects of kindness on student relationships. And you spent time in an elementary school classroom. So tell us about that. What acts of kindness did you witness that were difference makers in the classroom?
Well, I think one of the most important components of being an elementary school teacher is building the positive learning environment and setting the stage for those relationships with students, relationships between students, including administrators, that just set up an environment that's conducive to learning, where students can really thrive and feel safe and comfortable meeting their very basic needs first, you know, before trying to teach them about concepts of math and reading and whatever comes after that.
So teaching a kid about kindness is, you know, I mean, they all understand what the word kindness is, but actually teaching a kid how to be kind is, you know, its own art in and of itself, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I first started thinking of ideas for, I knew I wanted to write a book that encompassed social emotional learning. Mm-hmm. And when I first started to think of ideas for how I was going to, what that was going to look like in a book, I just wrote down ideas of everyday things that teachers can do, students can do, administrators can do, that sort of model kindness, but also amplify that message so that children can witness it and see it and identify with it. And then moving towards, you know, making those words sort of come to life with the rhythm. And
yeah, let's talk about the book. So the book is called The Day Built by Kindness, and you write it, the book kind of builds. So tell me about the main character. What happens in her day at the beginning?
So when I initially wrote the story, I was just thinking of a child who maybe has struggled in the morning. Like, there's so many things that can affect the
Adult struggle in the
morning. The adult struggle, right?
I struggle in the morning.
So just like the things that can affect them. And if a kid comes to school in the morning and they're on the wrong foot, you know, like it can be a struggle for them to then turn their day around and make that day a productive day of learning. So just all the small things that can happen to them throughout the day that can turn that morning around. But also just I think it would be a great tool in the classroom for teachers, like at the beginning of school, especially for kindergartners who have no idea what they're walking into. Or if you have a new student starting in a classroom, you know, just the various things that their classmates can do to make their day more comfortable, more inviting, empower them to be, you know, a part of the classroom and part of the community.
And you wrote it in like kind of a rhyming scheme. So I'm going to just... Here, I'll read one page so our listeners can understand. So, this is the task harder than ever, and the kind friend, they did it together. Thanks to the child who lent her a crayon, once the kind lady held her small hand, after the man that opened the door for the small child who looked to the floor. So, our listeners can get an idea. There's a rhyme in there. What made you, are you a rhymer?
I do like rhyme. I love reading stories with rhyme. Mm-hmm. It was the cumulative part of the story that was more appealing. That was sort of the direction I knew I wanted to go. The repetition of the story is really comforting for small learners. And I was thinking about some of the more fun books that I've read to students over the years, like The Gingerbread Man, and how it repeats over and over again at certain lines, mm-hmm. and the kids can expect it and sort of join in with the story. So what I did was thought back to basically what I think of as the original cumulative story, like the house that Jack built.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of modeled it after that, but instead of obviously a house, we're building a day of kindness. The rhyming part was, it's hard. That's a struggle, to find things that not only, that it's natural, I guess, is.
Yeah. It reminded me kind of if you give a mouse a cookie,
yeah.
where one thing leads to another, right?
Right.
So in the book, the main character just starts the day, has a bad day, but then it's you are pointing out all of the good things that happen throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
Give us some examples of some of the good things.
So I wanted the good things in the story to also be simple things that any child could do for another child, like just lend them a crayon. Mm-hmm. The teacher gave the child a sticker for a task that she completed during the day. An administrator who opened the door for the child to welcome them to school, the lady who held her hand to make her comfortable as she led her to her classroom.
This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we meet neighbors with an interesting story to tell. And we are talking with educator and children's book author Christina Taylor Florence about her book, A Day Built by Kindness. This is 89.7 NPR News. So your book celebrates those small acts of kindness,
yes.
that you just mentioned, opening a door, smiling. How did you decide which acts to include? Did you kind of just think about a school day and, you know, figure out where things might happen?
I did. And again, I wanted to make sure that they were simple things that anyone could do. You know, it's not going to be like bringing you flowers. You know, like those aren't things that kids can really do on a daily basis in a moment's notice. And I actually, in my pre-writing, just started writing down things from my memory that I witnessed that were small but meaningful and could really impact a child's day. And to remind, you know, teachers and educators, they all know that they're, you know, be kind to kids. That's a whole mantra in the education world. But just a reminder that even the smallest things that you do can help ease a child into a comfort and, you know, an acceptance in the community and sort of model that behavior for other students. When they see adults acting in a particular way that has a positive impact, they're going to emulate that.
What made you decide to write a book? I mean, you could just, you know, post on Facebook and say, be kind, you know. why write a children's book?
It's sort of always been an idea in my head. And my husband actually reminded me of that. And he, you know, when we were discussing, like, I was kind of at a crossroads in what I wanted to do and how I wanted to share my message.
You needed a new act in,
yes,
in your career.
Yeah. And he asked me, he's like, what have you always wanted to do? And it was just a reminder to me that I had said that years ago and I had repeated it when I was a full-time parent at home. I thought I was going to take that time to write a children's book, but that's a very busy period of life that really wasn't conducive to.
We all have dreams when we're at home.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. But also, like, I was a graduate of the University of Findlay. That's where I got my undergrad degree. And it houses one of the largest museums for children's literature.
Mm.
Illustrations. And it used to be housed in the basement of our library, Schaefer Library. And then when I was, you know, in the library working, we would pass by it all the time and I would see them. It was always just really inspiring to stop and look and, you know, kind of that little dream of, oh, wouldn't that be a great thing to do one day? So, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about the illustration. So you had you wrote it, but you didn't illustrate it.
So funny story. I started writing and I didn't really know where I was going to go from there. I did a lot of Googling. I did a lot of, like, I called it author stalking. Like, what do other people do? How do they make this work? Mm-hmm. My daughter is in New York City at Pratt Institute. And she was home over Christmas break when I was sort of battling with this. What do I do next? How do I make this whole concept come to life? Mm-hmm. And she started texting with a friend of hers. She worked at a barbecue restaurant in mm-hmm. Manhattan. And one of her really close friends and coworkers is an artist who graduated with his BFA. And he was sort of looking on what to do next as well. Mm-hmm. He's currently an art teacher in Brooklyn, he's always looking to expand and, you know, showcase his artwork. And he was willing to work with me. So it was his first book, my first book. So it made for a really great symbiotic relationship of trying to figure out how do an author and an illustrator, you know, form this connection and bring the story to life.
It's Callum Prinster.
Callum Prinster.
And the style of the illustrations is, you can see, I mean, it looks painted.
You can see.
So each one was a painting.
He's super talented. Like, his ability to take my words and bring them to life and sort of meet my vision was fantastic.
And he is the type of painter where you can see some of the brush strokes. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not making it perfect because I enjoy that. Life's not perfect, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it also, this project was a family affair. So
yes.
You explained that your husband encouraged you and that your daughter was a help.
Yes.
How else did the family help out?
So Grace is also she's getting her BFA in graphic design. It escaped me for a moment. So she actually set up she picked the font, which she took an entire course.
On picking font. Font is so important. Yes, font is so important.
It's incredible. So she picked the font. She digitally scanned the images and set them into the book, picked the colors for the pages. She designed the cover. Yeah, she played a really big role.
And then you self-published, right?
I did self-publish.
Okay, so tell me about that process, because I would have no idea where to even start.
I really didn't either. a lot of Google searches, honestly, and then just reading other people's experiences. I joined social media groups for authors and illustrators, and I haven't participated a ton. I'm more of like reading all the...
So you're author stalking and your internet stalking too.
Yeah. That's how I'm learning through other people. And eventually when I sort of have completed this process, which I'm really close, you know, I finished one book, then I'll be able to share my experiences and hopefully, you know, be able to help somebody else who's in the same position that I was in at the time.
Are you hoping to write more books?
Grace and I have just uploaded our second book.
Oh, it's already in the works.
It's already in the works. We're going to get our author copy and then just make sure everything looks the way we want it to look. It's actually on my website. It's uploaded, but it's sort of like a coming soon.
Okay. First, what's your website?
My website is flowrider.cargo.site.
Okay.
So
you're going to have to work on that.
I know, right? It's temporary, I'm sure, but in the process, I originally set up my own website, went through like GoDaddy and mm-hmm. created, it's all cookie cutter, and it was, I want to say easy, but I spent hours on it. Mm-hmm. And then when I showed it to my daughter, she was like, yeah, that's cute, but no. So she designed the new website, and right now it's just utilitarian. Like, it's a place for people to go where they can buy the books, and
yeah.
And it needs to be developed more.
So the next book that's
next
coming
book.
Soon, is it it's just still a children's book?
It's
is it similar?
It's not really similar. So this book, one of the learning standards for small people is learning the passage of time through the months of the year.
Okay.
But also understanding that weather changes over time. So I sort of combined those two elements, but put it through the eyes of a squirrel. So it's called Days Pass, A Year in the Eyes of, Through the Eyes of a Squirrel.
I love squirrels.
And it goes just month by month. When I was first teaching kindergarten, one of my favorite books to read with my kindergartners to sort of introduce the concept of months of the year, and then, you know, every month we would reread the poems, was called Chicken Soup with Rice. Sipping once, sipping twice, sipping chicken soup with rice.
All right. I don't know that one.
It just went month by month, and every mm-hmm. that particular phrase was repeated every time, but there was always something related to like what happens in January and what happens in February. And I really haven't seen anything new like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my inspiration for creating Days Pass.
All right. And is it a rhyming one like this
it
one?
It is rhyming, yeah.
Okay. So you're going to stick with the rhyming theme.
For now, yeah.
Did Callum illustrate it?
No.
Okay.
Grace illustrated it.
Oh, okay.
So interesting. She was, when all this was going down with Callum and myself and doing this book, she reached out and was like, Mom, her class was called Children's Illustration.
Oh.
And she knew she was going to be illustrating work that would be, you know, for children. But she was like, I need a story. I can either write a story or she could re-illustrate a book that already exists. And she was mm-hmm. like, do you have a story? And so I gave her the squirrel story.
The squirrel story.
And so she illustrated it, and she used digital collage.
Okay. Well, I look forward to seeing that one.
Yeah.
We have about a minute left, so we want to quickly say, where can people get your book? It's called A Day Built by Kindness.
Okay. So it is physically at Clintonville Books down in Clintonville, which is a brand new bookstore. You can get it at my website, flowrider.cargo.site. but it's on Amazon. It's in Walmart. It's at barnesandnoble.com.
Okay. So wherever your favorite place to get your book,
you can
find it.
Google search it and it pops up all the sorts of places.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Congratulations on
thank
the book.
You.
And good luck on getting the next one coming
thank
out.
Thank you so much.
And we've been talking with educator and children's book author Christina Taylor Florence. Her book is called A Day Built by Kindness. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And thank you to our listeners. Thanks for joining us. This has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep.